Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the gathering storm surrounding the slumlord billionaire owner of the NBA franchise, the Los Angeles Clippers, whose poisonous private racism has been exposed in a telephone conversation with his expensive mistress, overnight devaluing the millions Donald Sterling has spent over the years in self-promotion through paid advertising in the Los Angeles Times for staged banquets headlined by D-list celebrities, where he awarded himself honors such as Humanitarian of the Year. Ben Carrington, a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Race, Sport, and Politics, joins us to discuss the plantation mentality of billionaire owners of sports teams, some of whom look upon their players as personal chattel. Then we'll examine the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement between the U.S. and the Philippines, signed on the last stop of President Obama's trip to Asia, where he visited four countries involved in disputes with China. Joshua Kurlansik, a former columnist for Time, correspondent for The American Prospect, writer for Mother Jones, and author of Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, joins us to discuss China's displeasure at Obama's so-called pivot to Asia that they increasingly see as an attempt to contain China. Then finally, we will speak with Christopher Mitchell, the director of the Telecommunications as Commons Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, about the more than 400 towns and cities across America who have installed or are planning to install fiber broadband municipal networks as an alternative to the telecom and cable monopolies who appear to have captured Obama's FCC, which is poised to end the government's commitment to net neutrality. We will discuss the need to both support municipalities who are building networks to circumvent cable monopolies with high-speed broadband that other advanced nations enjoy, at the same time holding the FCC's feet to the fire so they don't sell out the public and abandon net neutrality. And joining us now is Ben Carrington, a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Carrington.
Hi.
And I'm not sure whether in Austin, Texas, the Donald Sterling story has quite the intensity that it has here in Los Angeles. And I must say there's a certain element of schadenfreude in it, in as much as over the years I've wondered about this man who keeps buying full-page ads in the L.A. Times almost every other day, awarding himself Humanitarian of the Year, Humanitarian of the Week, Humanitarian of the Month. There's a sort of rogues gallery of D-list celebrities that he has on these big full-page ads, and representatives of the NAACP and the Holocaust Museum and other sort of civic figures, if you will, all clearly buying a reputation. It's certainly based upon this leaked audio tape. no wonder he was trying to buy a reputation. The real story is so incredibly damning. So how do you explain this disconnect between this public figure, this owner, who has a team that's largely made up of African-American athletes, who can be so racist in his attitude towards his own players?
I think it tells us something about the different world that a lot of the owners live in, and the fact that in their minds they really do. They don't just own the club, they don't just own the franchise, they don't just own the teams, but to a large extent they really do believe that they own the players. And so I think we've just had a really interesting insight into the hyper privileged world that a lot of these owners, occupy. I mean, in coming from Texas, we have our own versions of what you've been finding out about Donald Sterling in Los Angeles. So Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, and even Mark Cuban, the owner of the Mavericks. I mean, these are characters who, to all intents and purposes, basically set up rules for themselves. And then they're not used to any type of pushback, any type of limitations on what they can get away with. So although the Donald Sterling empire seems to be collapsing by the minute, he's actually a lot more typical of the other owners than they would actually like to admit. Now, it does seem that some of his language is more extreme, but it's interesting that so few of the other owners have come out and spoken against him up until now, perhaps with the exception of Michael Jordan. One of the questions for me is, to what extent is Donald Sterling completely exceptional as an owner, or is he just actually... Has he gone slightly too far compared to what many of the other owners think and feel?
Well, it does feel like, just if reading the transcript of what's been made available of this apparently one-hour phone conversation with his mistress, a woman who his wife alleges is a money-grubbing seductress. Apparently she has a background as something of an expensive courtesan. He certainly showered. I think he bought 2 Bentleys, a Ferrari, and a Range Rover, as well as an expensive condominium. And it looks as though perhaps she may have even set him up, because some of these questions were quite leading. But her question to him was, do you know that you have a whole team that's black that plays for you? This is after he'd made all these racist statements. And just to get to what we were just talking about, this is what Sterling says. Do you know I support them? I give them food and clothes and cars and houses. Who gives it to them? Does someone else give it to them? Who makes the game? Do I make the game, or do they make the game? So there you have a kind of plantation mentality.
Absolutely. So it's not their hard work that has brought the wealth to the Clippers. It's not their... And I mean, let's remember, I mean, I think he initially invested something like about 12.5 million.
Yeah, 13.5, yeah.
Yeah, and it's now worth 50 times that. I mean, so he personally has benefited hugely from his association with the Clippers. But there's still this notion that he's the one that produces the wealth, he's the one that makes the wealth, and these players are just, they're just these kind of like workhorses that have no creativity, that, and in a sense that they should be lucky to be playing for his team. So you're exactly right. There is a plantation style mentality about how he views these black bodies, and there's almost like a certain almost disdain for their work, and even that he has to, the fact he refers to himself as given them food, given them clothes, given them cars, given them houses, as you say, it's the level of kind of the patronizing tone is just at one level it's remarkable, but another level actually I don't think it is, and it would be. If we were able to record some of the private conversations of many owners, I wouldn't be surprised if they were actually that different from what Sterling's been articulating.
So is this an international phenomenon then, not just in American sports, whether it be football or basketball? I mean, there's been some, I believe, isn't there an American that bought, was it Manchester United, one of the big soccer franchises in England? It's extremely unpopular. I'm not sure how the Russian oligarch, how popular he is with Chelsea. He certainly acted as though he'd won the cup and not them,
Yeah, but it's one of the noticeable differences when you look at the position of owners in European sports, and particularly if we take soccer as an example. So one of the things that's notable for me as a British transplant to the US is that at the end of most of the major sports championships, the cup is awarded to the owner. I mean, that's really striking. That would never happen in soccer. So hopefully in 2 or 3 weeks' time, if Liverpool manage to win the English Champions League, it will be Steven Gerrard, the Liverpool captain, who will hold up the championship trophy. So there's and the owners, so it's true, so the Glazers own Manchester United, and similarly Liverpool Football Club is now actually owned by Fenway Sports Group, who also own the Boston Red Sox. But the owners of English soccer teams have to be very careful about the extent to which they claim actual ownership, because in many of those, for many soccer fans in England and in Europe, there's a notion that the fans are actually the owners of the clubs, that there's a much stronger involvement of the fans, and the players sometimes have a much kind of greater say. So to such a degree that when Liverpool Football Club was taken over a couple of years ago by Tom Hicks and Gillette, that the owners were so disliked that it wasn't safe for them to actually go to the ground. Like, the Liverpool fans turned on them to such a degree. And even at Manchester United, the Glazers aren't actually that popular there. So there is much more fan control and fan democracy and fan the fans have a greater say over how these clubs are run. To some degree, that's kind of naive, and certainly the case that many English fans think they have a degree of ownership over the clubs in which they don't. Although in certain cases, such as Barcelona, they are actually cooperatives, so the fans actually are the collective owners of the club. So the, sure. There's a very different relationship between... And the very fact that in England and in much of Europe you would refer to these teams as clubs as opposed to franchises indicates the extent to which American sports leagues are much more commercially driven, with rich owners who, if they want to, can actually take the franchise from one city to another. It's inconceivable that Manchester United would leave Manchester and go to a different part of England. So there is a different relationship between the fans and the owners that you see in European sports as compared to the US.
Yeah, indeed, the exception to the rule here in the United States in terms of football, of course, is the Green Bay Packers, which is owned by the community. And the main reason why I always supported them, because I can't stand the Dallas owner and that whole ostentatious Texas thing about America's team, you know. It reeks of commercialism,
that,
you know.
Absolutely, and a team that makes money, a team that makes Jerry Jones even richer every year, and that's not successful. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things about the ways in which there's a false notion of competition within American sports, is that the rigging of the system to ensure that the teams that finish down the bottom of the table get a chance to recruit the players through the draft system, you know, the best players through the draft system the following year. And the fact that Sterling, I mean, many people suggested that one of the reasons why Sterling was tolerated for so many years was by some of the other owners, aside from his repulsive views and the ways in which as a slum landlord for many years he'd been exploiting working class people, was the fact that most of the other owners are quite happy to play a team that they know they can beat year after year. I mean, as long as Los Angeles for many years had a strong team in terms of the LA Lakers, it didn't really matter that the Clippers were so poor on the court. So actually, Sir Sterling was fine. He made money. The rest of the owners didn't really mind because there was an easy win every year. So you really do see the false hypocrisy of thinking about American sports as being this kind of pinnacle of American capitalism when the system is really rigged.
Again, I'm speaking with Ben Carrington, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for Sociology of Sports. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. So in terms of your latest book, Ben Carrington, you couldn't have more of a confluence of race and sport. And, of course, the politics are happening now with the NBA commissioner, and it's now a huge press story in terms of Sterling. He hasn't said anything yet, and, you know, obviously there's some sort of ridiculous double talk about the idea that, you know, we've got to wait until this tapes or authenticated, when it's pretty clear that it is what it is. But there's nothing more flagrant than his racist statements and the idea that he could actually bring by his, you know, girlfriends and hookers and others. I mean, he actually sued a former hooker who he called a $500 a night trick. He actually, that all got on the public record because he sued her, because he was sick. He wanted back the house and the expensive cars he'd given her and the huge amount of money he's given her. And presumably that's going to happen with the latest one. But he used to traipse these women through the locker rooms after the games where all the players are showering, and would say to these women, look at those beautiful black bodies. I mean, again, it's just so odious and so plantation-like. It's sickening.
Yeah, but that's one of the interesting things about this is, I mean, what you've just mentioned and what you've just described, this isn't somebody like hiding away and doing these things in private. I mean, actually, if you go back to the transcript, one of the interesting things about it actually was, it wasn't so much that he was upset with his girlfriend or whoever she was kind of hanging out with Magic Johnson. It was the fact that she was doing this in public, you know. So in his mind, that, you know, she couldn't do these things in public; they had to be kept in private. Any kind of relationship she had with black athletes, when everything he was doing was in public. I mean, I think this is also a story about Los Angeles and Los Angeles politics. The fact that the NAACP of Los Angeles were willing and had honoured him over many years is an example of the fact that he was clearly savvy enough politically to know that if he donated money to the local chapter, that would give him a degree of cover. So actually, I think that as much as this is a story about the NBA and Sterling, it's also a story, I think, about the ways in which racial politics operates in a city like Los Angeles, where wealth can buy you access and allow for you to engage in practices that otherwise wouldn't be tolerated. You know, and so in many ways, he's been caught out by his own kind of, you know, arrogance. But also, we need to think about who else made it possible. Who were the kind of the players, if you like, in the kind of Los Angeles system that kind of tolerated him for so long as he was writing checks?
Well, it's sort of the old joke, you know, if you strip off the tinsel of Hollywood and Los Angeles, underneath there's real tinsel. You know, this is a guy, as I say, every other day in the LA Times, there's full-page ads of him, pictures of him smiling there with all of these D-list celebrities that he's managed to get out for a rubber chicken dinner and thrown a few dollars their way. And invariably, again, you know, representatives of the NAACP and the Holocaust Museum and others would join in this pantheon of, you know, minor celebrities. So I just don't understand how somebody could have spent so much money on trying to make themselves into creating this kind of image of respectability and at the same time be such a poisonous, loathsome human being. I mean, I guess it could only happen here in Hollywood.
Yeah, but it's a good example of hubris, isn't it? I mean, this is what a certain degree of wealth gives you. It gives you a sense of entitlement. It produces a sense of privilege, in which you begin to lose sight of the normal constraints that the rest of us have to live by. And I think also, I mean, he's unfortunate in this sense. I mean, he's probably sitting there thinking one of the interesting things is the extent to which sponsors are now pulling support away from the Clippers. I mean, if it's one thing for there to be kind of media outrage, it's one thing for people on Twitter and social media to begin to be criticizing him. But as soon as the major sponsors begin to pull away from the Clippers, which looks like they're doing right now, that's significant. And so he's probably sitting there thinking, like, what did I do? Like, what suddenly changed? Well, I mean, he was unfortunate enough to be in the same news cycle as Clive and Bundy. So in terms of the kind of context of this week's news cycle, there was no questions of race were in the news a lot this week. And one of the other interesting aspects of this, I think, is quite interesting, is the extent to which many of the players themselves have actually been very vocal. You know, once you have a league which is 70-75%, maybe 80% African-American, and you have a number of those players who do have a media platform, they're not going to be taking such sentiments lightly. They're going to speak out, and they have been speaking out much more forcibly, actually, than the owners and the NBA itself, which, as you said, is trying to still toe this line, like trying to toe the line that we need to authenticate the tape first, we can't rush to judgment, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, in this kind of news cycle age, that doesn't cut it. So there's a kind of a pincer movement whereby, you know, as some people said, you know, it's been a bad week to be a white male racist, and it's, you know, and that's not always the case. Like, normally,
well, it should be a bad week every week.
It should be, but it's not. Right. So it's just,
in closing there, Ben, don't you think that at the end of the day, this guy, whose his real name is Donald Tokowitz, who grew up in the poor side of town here and has now, you know, lives in the marbled mansions in Beverly Hills and has paid all this money to burnish his reputation as the humanitarian of the year, the century of the galaxy. He is still going to make a ton of money when he's forced to sell this franchise, if it comes to that.
True, yeah, just as the slave owners often argue that they need to be compensated for when they had to give up slavery. So it'll be interesting to see. His reputation is shot, and it will be fascinating. I mean, it's a great American story. It's a great Los Angeles story. I mean, I'm sure I can see the script writers and screenplay writers of Los Angeles run into their computers right now to kind of hack out a mini biopic.
If only we had Nathaniel West alive today. Well, I think...
Hopefully it will put to rest this myth that has been circulated since 2008, predominantly by the Wall Street Journal and others, that we now live in a post-racial society. I mean, this is in the same week that the Supreme Court kind of struck down the Michigan case around affirmative action, so, I mean, we need to read these things concurrently. The stuff around Clive and Bundy, the kind of attacks on Obama, the attacks by the Supreme Court against affirmative action. And in the midst of this, we actually see revealed actually some of the kind of the stark reality of the existence of forms of anti-black racism within American society today.
Well, Ben Carrington, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ben Carrington. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement the U.S. has just signed with the Philippines.